But at the end of the day, if you have a great product and no one knows about it, does the product even exist? It's like a tree fell in the woods, right? Well, technically everything's a wrapper. Like your web UI is a wrapper on a database. Why don't we just give people credentials to the database? Identifying the negative use case and then addressing it doesn't necessarily have to be implement everything and be everything to everybody.
Welcome to Artificial Insights, the podcast where we interview innovators and leaders in AI to learn how AI is changing the future of work and business. Today, I'm joined by Alex Millar, and I've been excited to have this conversation because Alex has jumped back into building for one of the hardest customer segments out there, government. Alex is the co-founder and CTO of GovAI.com, a platform bringing safe, contextual AI to public sector organizations. And this isn't his first company. In fact, back in 2012, he quit his job at Microsoft to co-found Bonfire, a procurement platform for government. And that company went through Y Combinator, raised a Series A, and was acquired in 2019 for $108 million. And with GovAI, he's combining deep domain experience with new AI capabilities to build something that's getting adopted in a space where trust and compliance matter just as much as functionality. Alex, can you start us off by telling us a little about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm Alex. I'm a CTO and co-founder of GovAI.com. Previously built and sold a company, Bonfire, here in Kitchener-Waterloo. Website domain's gobonfire.com. Did that for about 10 years. That was building and selling software to government, and now we're doing a new company to build and sell software to government. So I know a thing or two about selling software and building for government. I mean, we'll dive into it today because we're doing a whole like AI-specific product offering, yeah, right, for government. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm interested too in hearing the story of how you arrived at that, because I believe you guys were Civia AI at first, and now you're Gov AI, or maybe not even Civia AI, just Civia.
Yeah, I can touch on that briefly. So we're still officially Civia from a business registration perspective. And we initially set out to build, let's call it a version of LinkedIn for government. That was our initial vision. And we saw this a lot when we were building Bonfire of, you know, there's a lack of peer groups knowledge. They're all old school kind of email lists that go out for people getting help in government. And we started to build some of that kind of stuff at Bonfire, community groups and whatnot. And we were helping people out. We looked at it and said, LinkedIn is an amazingly lucrative business, right? Like when you look at their fundamentals for their average revenue per user, their ARPU, compared to their like time on site, it's like crazy, right? I can't remember the exact stats, but it's like their ARPU, I think, is higher than Facebook for lower time on site, which is wild. So that's initially what we started doing. And we got going and, you know, bootstrapping, it's a cold start problem, right? Bootstrapping a two-sided network is very difficult. So we started experimenting as ChatGPT was coming out on the scene of like, what would our own version of this look like for government, right? And that starts maybe just as a bit of a wrapper, right? An experiment. Because our idea was like, help people get and seek the knowledge that they need to do their job better. And our initial version was like, use humans to do that through a social network and pair up the right people when you have questions and answers and topic analysis of their questions and routing this stuff. It evolved now because we experimented with this. Well, what about AI? And we found that people preferred to talk to a machine instead of talking to their peers. And that kind of makes sense from a, if you're uncertain about something in your job and you don't feel comfortable and you don't want to ask a stupid question, well, it's nice to just Google that or talk to ChatGPT or whatever, right? Versus trying to put a post out in a form or ask on Slack or Team or something like that. So it's a pivot, but it's not a massive pivot. But a lot has also changed with the business because now it's more of a, we're not building something that we just want tons of people to use to then monetize later, let's say. Now it is, no, this is a product that we sell to you directly to your organization. And there's a lot more that kind of goes into the actual product. So that's the start. It was Civia. And now we acquired the domain govai.com. So we're operating as that. So we are like Civia doing business as govai.com.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's pretty cool actually that the initial vision of getting people to connect with each other to help is now almost the same thing, but you're changing the way that people will get that help rather than direct peer-to-peer.
Yeah, and I can touch on this a little. Well, I touch on it now, but I have a vision a little bit later to get really specific on AI stuff. Okay, we have an assistant and we can do tool calls. What if one of those tool calls is, I want to talk to a human and I can find you the right human to talk to about your thing and then recommend, well, Susan and this is an expert in zoning law on indigenous land or something like that. And so we can, maybe you want to reach out to her to check or look into some of the specifics there. So I still think there's a path of like a human expertise in the loop with this LLM that we kind of plan to do it a little, but it requires a bit more of scale, right? Like you need more people on the platform and opting into this kind of path, but there's a vision of my mind for that later on.
I really like that view of a human being a tool that an LLM can call. That's
sounds a little
bridge.
Pithy, right? Like technically it's a tool call that the LLM does, which calls an API, which does a search to find a human and recommend someone to you. Yeah. So the human is not the tool. The database search is the tool. Yeah. And then you can click a button and email them or send them a message, right? So yes, just to be clear, if that gets clipped, I'm not saying humans are tools.
No, but keeping the human expertise in the loop as one of those options is something that I've heard discussion about, like where's that use case for humans versus the LLM and that boundary.
Yeah.
But the question I wanted to ask you is something that I think people wonder a lot about a podcast like this is, Alex, are you an AI?
Am I an AI? I'm an I. I'm real. I'm a real boy. Yeah, I don't know. Is this a simulation? What are we living in? What does life mean? I don't know. Dan, that's a big question.
I had one person I interviewed who is a professor at Waterloo say, no, but I'm about to be because they're making a chatbot of me for a course assistant. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a hard term, right? Because it's now left, let's say, the technical term from like the distinction between ML and AI to just a generic massive category. So it's, you know, if someone says, what is AI? It's just, well, are we talking about technical academic definitions? Are we talking about business use cases? You know, all the rest, right? And it's all changing so fast, right? I kind of view it as it's basically, it's like, look, broadly speaking, these category of AI tools, using AI in your business is just like when we went away from writing stuff by hand to typewriters to then like computers, like this is just, it's another step up, you know, stepwise function, or not stepwise, but you know what I mean? Like a massive change, you know, combustible engine, even like the innovation of the postage stamp, like that was a big deal. It's like a fixed cost for sending communications, right? That was a massive change. So this is one of those things, right? That is what I view AI as. And it's something that you need to like learn and get involved with and take advantage of, because you don't go, I mean, the Meta Knights do, but you don't go to the store on a horse and buggy anymore, right? You drive a combustible vehicle with a combustible engine, right? Or electric, you know,
Then for you, then would you say AI is just another type of tool and it has use cases and things you do with it that you wouldn't before?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's fundamentally new in the sense it's not, oh, we can move somewhere faster or we can communicate at a fixed cost anywhere in the country. It is this, I can take fuzzy inputs and get fuzzy outputs or kind of structured outputs. Because as a developer, you're like, oh, like there's a strict sequence of logic, right? And I have to format my request like this, but now I can just give you text or whatever, and it can figure out the JSON payload to go and call this API most of the time.
That's true. Not all the time. Yeah. Do you present the AI and the AI functionality to your customers or buyers?
Yeah, it really depends on who you're talking to, right? I mean, that is with anything in selling, right? So, you know, if someone's deeply competent in there, then you're going to jump, you know, you're going to kind of get suss that out in the beginning of the conversation. And so we are, generally speaking, talking to early adopters who see there's a benefit, aren't sure what solution is right for them, both from a, does it meet our compliance, security, privacy, you know, organization controls, like all these things, right? Does it meet our needs there? What's the price point for this? You know, even small things, right? Like $20 a user a month for ChatGPT doesn't seem like that much money. But if you have 800 employees at a small town, that's a lot of money relative to your city budget. You know, we do. So we're talking, we meet them where they're at in terms of like what they can afford, what license model makes sense for them, making sure that we meet all their needs from like almost the layer around just the application, right? Let's say an assistant, if we're going to do that category of ChatGPT is an assistant, you know, chat-based assistant versus Microsoft Copilot, or they've rebranded a few times, right? But the thing that comes with Microsoft. And so we're trying to build a version of that, you know, for people today. And you can say like, okay, is that just a wrapper? And it's like, well, technically everything's a wrapper. Like your web UI is a wrapper on a database. Why don't we just give people credentials to the database? So where it becomes a problem is if you can't differentiate and deliver more, like everything's a wrapper that delivers more value, right? Uber is a wrapper on you driving to the grocery, to the store and picking it up yourself, but you still are happy to do it because they increase the value of what you get. Yes, you pay more, but you increase the value for you. So these are things that we're doing in terms of, let's say, wrapping or providing a similar product, but we have a vision and a path. I mean, even the small thing I talked to you about there, hey, can we have a tool call for human in the loop expertise of specific government peers, right? That kind of ties into this, okay, I'm serving a niche and I'm doing things specifically for them, right? And building something that they want, right? That serves them versus it's maybe a little more generic that's trying to serve everybody. Anyways, this is very tangential there. So kind of coming back to like, how do you talk to them? How do you describe it? As is with anything in sales, right? It's meeting the person where they're at and taking them on that journey to understand.
I think that story of how you present it to a user is key to understanding that user and helping them understand why they would want to use AI. Yeah, even if it's just a wrapper, it is the wrapper that I have to use in my situation, not some other situation. And even all those things you mentioned, like compliance, that's a huge deal for a government. So knowing that they need it, telling them that you have it, it's a big difference.
Yeah, for example, and they're still all trying to figure it out as well too, right? And there's other things too. I mean, it's like we say we kind of try to deliver that Apple Store experience where, you know, you also get a human that's going to help you and figure, and not just, oh, here's your account manager, but we run active training sessions and peer groups that are organized with like different cities to work together to because everyone's still learning how to really take advantage of this stuff. And there are some great shiny demos that are like the happy path that makes you maybe think it can do everything. And like, it's possible, like you can do a lot of stuff as you get into like agentic workflows and all these things, but there's still so much value in even some of the mundane use cases that people just, it's a whole new thing. The muscle memory haven't reached for it yet. Like my favorite example, something I do almost every day, when I'm writing requirements, and this is like software requirements, right? Is I'll have an idea of what I want. I'll have written it down to be like, here's the functionality. I want you to build this, add this, do all these things. And then I'll use this kind of like, make the LLM pretend or be the junior dev I'm assigning this work to and reading it. And I say, LLM, read this as if you're a junior developer who is still just joined a company a month ago. And tell me what things might be confusing to a junior developer that weren't clear and concisely described in my requirements. And then I say, well, your spec was really good, but these were kind of ambiguous and it wasn't clear. Here are some suggestions. And then I say, and then suggest the changes, revisions to my thing to help make it clear to that, you know, junior developer. And so that's me doing it in software, but you could abstract that to any form of requirements. Like you have a task you're going to give to somebody. It's very easy when you, as a project manager, when you're like, I give requirements, but it's not clear because it was clear in your mind, but you failed to give all of the context in your mind into this. So you just do a quick prompt, whether it's whatever tool you're using, like to an LLM to say, can you judge this, you know, review this as them and tell me before I give it to them and then have to wait 3 days. And then they go, it wasn't clear to me. And then we're delayed, right? I can just nip that in the bud out the gate, right? There's all sorts of like little patterns and use cases like, oh, I didn't realize I could do that. Oh, I should just do that all the time, right? These are things we're discovering with our clients. Again, serving a niche as opposed to serving everybody. And then putting on rails in terms of the actual product experience because we are serving a niche for those more highly repetitive workflows, right?
And it sounds like serving the niche allows you to figure out the common needs. If the niche were too broad, you wouldn't have any idea like how to serve everybody at once.
Well, then it's not a niche, right? Or a niche, or however you want to pronounce it. Yeah. So it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's making something people want. And like you mentioned earlier, where it's like, oh, well, you know, I was a feature and then ChatGPT added something and now my startup's toast, right? And you have to be more than just a feature. And part of that is some of the times the product, like the literal like software that you're building. Part of it's sometimes the offering, right? Like a small thing I can say about right now about our model, again, for serving our customers is they pay a flat fee that's determined roughly based on, let's say, their city size and employee size, but it's not a per user license model. So this is the equivalent of like, I'm planning my wedding. Am I paying per drink or am I paying the flat bar fee? It's yes, the house always wins, but We can't have variable costs as like a city. It needs to be fixed. And I don't want to have to pick who gets to use this and who doesn't, like, because it's, you know, I want to be able to make it available for everyone. So can someone replicate that? Yes, that's just how you're offering your pricing, right? But it's all these little things that layer up that make it the right product. The, you know, it resonates and it aligns. And that's why people want to use, you know, you versus something else that's maybe not as aligned for them. That could work, but it's not aligned for them, right? So
yeah, I really appreciate the view of positioning as part of the product. Essentially, the offer and the software have to go together and align for the niche. There's a book by, her name is April Dunford, called Obviously Awesome. Best book I've ever read on positioning. I'll put a link in the chat for that later. But I wanted to ask you about, you made a comment that your previous approach with Civia was kind of like the social network approach of not charging up front, getting lots of users. But you said that now you're actually selling a product.
Yeah.
And to me, that said charging money for what you have now. Could you go into the differences between those and how you moved to that?
Yeah. So we sell a product. We also have a PLG, product-led growth motion, where people can use the product for free, a basic version of that. And that helps. It's the cost. Like, do you do outbound sales? Do you do inbound? Do you offer something? You know, we've got a bit of a mix here. So we started building out our initial version of our chat-based assistant and flushing that out. And, you know, adding, you know, whether it's retrievals, capabilities, code interpreter, like all these things. And people were using it. And we said, okay, we're going to offer this additional functionality that meets the niche's needs, like PII, token detection, and redacting, let's say, right? And a really way you can customize and configure rules for that. And even little things like, hey, we want to have our own acceptable use policy that we define for our city staff, right? That's loaded in there and make sure that staff agree to it prior to use, right? And different forms of training, like kind of built in there. We flushed out some of these features around there, single sign-on, SAML-based, like all this stuff. And so that becomes the like, hey, I'm buying the enterprise version, I get these things. And we're continuing to add more, and those are features just in the enterprise version we're working on right now. We're calling them folios. I think the industry term that's going on is like an org rag, like your organization's information, let's load it up, let's get it rag ready, right? Chunked and embedded so that the staff can ask questions and it can pull from the relevant organization literature that specific person in the staff has access to, right? So that's something that's on our enterprise paid plan versus our free individual plan. Yeah. And we, with Bonfire Sold, did, you know, outbound sales, right, for years to the government. So we know how to do it. And so people are using it for free. We see their usage bubble up. We talk to them and reach out and say, hey, you know, it looks like you're enjoying getting a valuable product. It can do this many more things. Do you want to talk? Here's what our pricing looks like for our early partners, because we're still early. Here's where it's going. And we take people through that journey and close the deal and send out an invoice and kind of rinse, repeat, right? So
I guess what was the biggest difference between the social network approach of maybe someday monetizing and the current approach of something that gets you in the door, but you know how you're monetizing right away? Is that a requirement for AI businesses, or is that something that just works for you?
I think this has nothing to do with, or I take one step back from the question, which is to say that whether it's an AI business or any form of business, right? Like ultimately at the end of the day, there are, let's say, a series of metrics that you want to grow aggressively. The best possible metric you could be, and you say, I want to grow this metric 10% week over week, right? Which is like 3x annualized or whatever, right? Or month over month or whatever it is, right? The best possible metric is profit. I want to grow profit 10% week over week. Okay, it's not profit. Okay, then I want to grow ARR. Okay, then I want to grow revenue. Then I want to, well, what are all the lagging indicators of those things, right? And so if you're building a product that is offered for free, that the only way to make money, i.e. the classic social network, is through monetizing the usage, then the only metric you can probably do until you monetize is daily active users. Then you focus all your attention towards how do I get daily active users, right? But when you have something you offer and you sell, and then again, the dynamics of our users where they buy annually, they pay up front, right? And they're not slow to adopt, but like it's not private sectors, like you buy and let's implement like next week often. If you're a big org, like no, this scale of projects, right? Well, you know, they might take a little bit of time to adopt and they're on their own pace and it's all new. So people are trying to figure out how to use it. We've earned the ARR. We have it. We will have it for the whole year. Like it gets recognized monthly. And then it's on us to then track the measures of usage and making sure that the customers are successful for that so that we can retain that ARR next at the end of the year. That they don't come to the end of the budget cycle and say, you know what? We never really got off the ground with this. We're not seeing that much value. It's not worth it. Let's leave. But again, that's the dynamic of our customers, right? You don't, and we've learned this through building for government in the past. You don't see midterm churn that often. It's their contract. They have so many contracts and stuff going on that their lifecycle manager will be like, oh, it's coming up for renewal in 3 months. Are we going to renew? Or even with Bonfire, we eventually got to a point where most people were signing multi-year contracts and paying up front. And that's because they're cutting over a major business process. So it took a long time before they chose to buy, but once they bought, like they were in, right? And so today our offering is not as broad. We have 10 years of building a company, what we do, but this is where we intend to get over time, where the chat assistant is one of many things where we want to, will, and intend to be the vendor of record, so to speak. When it's like, I want to do stuff with AI at my organization, what am I going to buy? It's like, well, we can buy from GovAI, we can get this assistant, we can get, you know, I mean, I don't want to speculate too much about like where we may go, but other classes of like, okay, just API access, so I don't have to have a separate, I can just call an API to get LLM completions if we want to build our own stuff. We're considering, you know, a citizen-facing engagement tool over time and other workflow tools. So yeah, I'm meandering a little bit, I think, from your question there, Dan, a bit, but it's not so much that how do you sell, what do you have to do specific as an AI company? It's just in general, it's like your company, what is the appropriate metric for your company? And trying to be as bootstrapped company and be like, we want to grow profit 10% week over week. So we make $0. So that's stupid. We should choose an appropriate metric right now. And I mean, nobody sets profit 10% week over week as their metric, but obviously if you could, you'd be like,
if you could,
you know, you're basically printing money at that point. Yeah.
In your case, then that means the choice to have the free tier plus the, like somebody's now using it, let's sell them the enterprise edition, is working backwards from what usage looks like. You know that usage gives this value. So then you can start selling after the threshold of usage. Does that sound right?
Yeah. And we're trying it from both approaches. So we're not yet at this, like we are a pure PLG company and we're not currently, we're a pure direct sales. Like we're doing both and the proof will be in the pudding over again, because we've only really pivoted into this beforehand. Like if we were doing PLG before and like mass email marketing, because it was a free social network, you're not going to call users one by one to say, use this, right? So we were able to draft off some of that previous work we did in PLG and set the product up for that, to do that here now. And it's working and it helps, and there's some organic growth and people can invite new people in and it lets them try it and get started, which is also unique for, I think, government products, products built for government, because usually you're adopting a solution to do some big business problem. So I wouldn't say it's so much, yeah, this is some master strategy for AI products to do both. It's just, that's where we are. It is working. We're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But where we really double down will be borne out based on data-driven analysis of where's our money best spent, doing PLG or having BDRs and going to trade shows and meeting with people and shaking hands and kissing babies.
And right before this, I talked to one of our mutual friends who was my first interview for this show, Anwar, and he mentioned that from his discussions with you, it sounds like you now recognize what demand looks like for the company. Like he said, as a new entrepreneur, recognizing what demand is, it's not waiting for the market to catch up. It's waiting for people waiting for you to build them the things that they've asked you for.
It can be. I mean, you know, there's, I think the flip side is sometimes the entrepreneur is like, I look into the future. That's where we were going to be here. And I like build to that. Now, maybe like you build to that and then the future arrived and you already had the product, like a calculator, you know what I mean? The people didn't know they wanted calculators. So it's like, we should have a machine in our pocket that can do math. And I will spend $10 million building the first calculator. And now you can get them for a penny or dollars at the dollar store. So yeah, I think it's more about building a startup and getting started. You are falling from the sky, trying to build a plane before you hit the ground. Doesn't have to be a great plane. You got to not hit the ground. But you know, to do that, you basically have to be like, I have created something that resonates with people and delivers value to them. And I have figured out how to efficiently tell people about it and get it into their hands. I think that's the thing that a lot of technical people forget or undervalue or just don't understand or resent or feel uncomfortable doing. I don't want to toot my own horn. I'm not going to post on LinkedIn and all these other things and all the rest. But at the end of the day, if you have a great product and no one knows about it, does the product even exist? It's like a tree fell in the woods, right? Like,
yeah.
You got to make a noise. People got to know, right? And this is where hiring and having excellent sales and marketing people in your company is important. And then it's a question of timing. So often you need to build the product first, get it working, do it yourself with some early customers, and it's successful. So it makes sense to lean in and spend that money to bring in that sales and marketing talent. Or you have no money, you have no revenue, they're coming in, you know, on equity and we're all taking no salary for future, right? Whatever it is. But the point is, you know, you can't sell what you don't have. But once you have something, if you fail to get good sales and reps in and understanding, you're going to end up dead in the water, likely. It's unlikely that you can just put up a website and a domain and say, it's here. And then all of a sudden it's like, everyone's like, I want it. And it went viral somehow. Like, those things go viral sometimes by accident. But these days, I think it's very, not engineered, but people are trying. Like, it wasn't an accident when a big brand, you know, did a launch and it went there. Like, they put a lot of money at trying to go viral and getting up there.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were saying too that you can look for a signal for when it's time to put that money into sales and marketing. What have you seen that would be that signal?
I mean, you could do it. You can get signals, like you can poll your users of your current product. Let's say it's early, it's free, and it's there. And it says, if I took this away from you today, how would you feel? And they'd be like, the sky's falling. Don't take it away from me. It's like, whatever. I don't care. And so if you have a high percentage of people being like, no, if they took this away from me, this would be a problem. It's okay, cool. I'm delivering value. So sometimes you have to put that quite, you know, people do NPS scores, like how likely are you to recommend a company, but putting it more on the nose to basically say, look, if I deleted the code, would that be a problem for you? Yes or no? Doesn't have to be like a yes, no, maybe, just yes or no. And you're like, majority of people say yes. Okay, I don't want to delete the code. Okay, we need to make money. Okay, time to sell. That could be an easy way to do it. But however you arrive at, that's how you need to arrive at, right? Like, the metric being like, I asked people and they resoundingly said, yes, I would be extremely upset if you got rid of this. That's a pretty strong signal that you're onto something. So at least with that group, then it's a different question of, does that expand out? You might have picked a super teeny niche of, I don't know, Gen X woodworkers living specifically in Alaska with red hair, right? That's just, okay, that was probably too much of a niche for your product. You might need, you know, even though they said that, your TAM was pretty low, right? Conversely, like, I have this big, great big TAM, but that TAM is not representative of what you do. You know what I mean? That's also a problem, right? Because people like think their TAM is so big, but really your TAM is really small, because not that you were building for a small thing, but like, the people you're testing with who said yes and all this stuff only represent a very small subset of that TAM. So
yeah, there's going to be some kind of, right, these people want it, but how representative is that of the wider audience as well?
Sure. And but like, a majority of businesses aren't billion dollar valuation, billion dollar revenue, whatever. There are a lot of great businesses out there that you've never heard of that serve a small group of people that aren't, I mean, not even software businesses, but in general, right? You know, you can get really held up onto that, and it can be a problem if you're like, I'm going to go down the VC path and raise hundreds of millions of dollars, and there's no market space for that. That's where that becomes a problem, if those things are misaligned. But it's not inherently a problem, right? It just guides what it is you're doing. And then as long as the people in that group are willing to pay the appropriate amount of money for what you're delivering, for you to have decent margins and be able to grow sustainably, then you're great. You figured it out. Congratulations. You know, like, that's really hard to do. It's uncommon.
Yeah. Sustainable business. Sounds like the dream.
Yeah.
So I was also really interested in talking to you about maybe the more technical side of it. And RAG has been in the public consciousness for a while. Agents are getting to be a really interesting thing. What are interesting or clever ways that you guys have used the technology in this context with government?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, there are times when I look at this and look at what other people are doing and I feel like a caveman. You know what I mean? But I also then recognize when I turn around and say, that's relative to the top AI engineers building this stuff at OpenAI and all the rest. But then I turn around over here and say, I'm from a knowledge perspective, I'm probably in the top 1% right now. You know what I mean? Because I literally am using this stuff day in and day out and thinking about how to not only use LLMs and the technology for a business, but then also how they fundamentally work, and then also how to deliver an offering. I'm getting it from all three sides to like my own customers. Whereas most people who are in their job are probably like, okay, there's some initiative, there's a tool for us, I still got to do my day job, you know, I'm not in the thick of it. A big thing that I'm thinking about, and there are, we're, you know, we're getting started with it and it's going to get more advanced over time. When you think about RAG, is that's been drilled into me and I'm working on building that out for how that makes sense for our product, is evals being the short term evaluations, which is basically tests. How do you test this stuff? So there's the lingo, but it's, we write code, you write tests, the tests say it works, great. So I can ship it and I'm confident, right?
Yeah. How do you test something that has fuzzy output? Like, yes, that is a good question. Yeah.
Yes. So when it comes to RAG specifically, we want to get really technical for a couple minutes. I've learned and I'm adopting and doing, and how do you get good at this over time is to say, okay, RAG, retrieval augmented generation, the G is like the LLM taking the output and then rephrasing it. The way I like to think of it and try to explain it to people is you can ask a sentence and I can do, we can do a RAG right now. Daniel, I want to go out for Chinese food for dinner tonight. Then you would go and you say, I'm going to Google Chinese restaurants in Kitchener. Then you're going to take the top three results that come back and you're going to say, there is a restaurant here. It's well known for whatever, because you took that text from those snippets, right? So how could I test that, right? Well, the end-to-end test is slow and expensive because it requires like going through a full LLM iteration to say, do an LLM call. It does a generate. It does a completion with a tool call to the RAG and all sort of stuff. But you don't really need to test, or you can at some point, but the thing you really want to test is, once I had a search term, did I get the right chunks, the right snippets back? And so building, because what goes on in that search is not just like, you know, full text search of like the search term had Chinese food and then the restaurant had Chinese food in their SEO. So like, that's not how search works. That's how basic search works, but that's not how Google search works, right? So there's a ton of stuff under the hood there. So the retrieval augmented, the RA, like you're testing that, or it's really testing the R. And then the AG is augmented generation. It's just taking the Google results, basically, in a simple analogy. And then instead of giving you the HTML of those back or the JSON of those back, it just, the AI rewrites that into a nice paragraph or sentence or whatever, right? So there are methods and techniques where you can say, I know this is in the output for this term. So I'll make a test that says, given this term, I expect to get these three chunks of text, right? And given this input, I get to do these. And then you can, there's methodology for that. So I'm kind of in the weeds on there and it's something I'm learning and getting involved in, but it's something that's important when you think about, this doesn't really have to do with, oh, hallucinations are quote unquote problematic things with LLM. It has to do with, does the system deliver value to the user? When they ask, who was the last person that edited this? Let's say you install some tool that does org RAG, right? So it ingests your org data and it makes it available to you through Slack or Teams or a web app or whatever. And you're asking questions of saying, who last ordered, you know, X, Y, and Z product? And it doesn't give you an answer, right? And you're like, oh, then the user's not getting value. And you could say, oh, the system's not designed to do that because that data's on the RAG, but it doesn't really matter. The user wanted to use it that way. They thought they could, they didn't, they're upset, they don't want to use the product. So like evals is setting up your ability to do those tests and then actually tracking what the users are attempting to achieve and are they getting what they expect and then how can I change it? And so in that case, it might be like, let's say not who last, well, that case, like there might not be the data in the RAG to answer the question, who last ordered this? Or you needed a more specific tool call or need to change your search function to have more multi-parameters. It's not just text that's, and then search this source. Don't search the documents, search in Salesforce and do a search there and get the data back, right? Anyways, this is a little meandering, but I'm thinking a lot about evaluation and testing and confidence so that you can then get a systematic flywheel in place to actually say it's good and then to confidently make a change. I can change the behavior of my search algorithm, test to see, does it actually objectively make it better? And that's not even doing an LLM tool call. It's just testing a bunch of searches and saying, when I do this search, I'm expecting to get these results. Did I get them? I changed the search algorithm and it's, oh, now I'm getting less. For these ones, I'm getting less results, but for these ones, I'm getting more. I'm like, oh, interesting. Why did that change? Yeah. Anyways, I'll stop there because there's a lot to talk about evals and I'm not by no means an expert on it, but I think it's a big place. And whether you're doing assistance and just LLM completions with tool calls for data access, or you're getting into agentic workflows, it's still going to be the same thing, right? It just gets even worse with agentic workflows because it's kind of like
layers on layers.
What's the one, the floating point error where the rocket, you know, crashed? What's that big one where it's like, oh, it's just a
rounding.
We
yeah.
did it in a loop and it was a little bit off and then the trajectory, you know, completely went off course.
Yeah.
So we're not using agents to launch rockets into space, but
thankfully
the analogy holds in terms of compounding errors, you know, through the system.
Yeah. 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 Now, you said something that was, I think, really insightful about how the current generation of AI is different than a previous generation of AI, because you use the case of where the user wants to ask a question about who ordered this product, but the information is not in the system.
Yeah.
Now, generally, previously, that's not something that could happen if the information wasn't in the system. Like, I would go to my ERP and ask that question. It should be there. I wouldn't go to Salesforce. But with this case, you're actually giving so much flexibility to the user, they're probably going to ask things of it that you didn't expect them to ask, that it wasn't set up to ask. And you're going to have to handle the negative cases, not just the positive cases, really gracefully.
Yeah. And a simple solution for that can be like, look, we studied the data, we got all these questions, and we used an LLM, whatever, to categorize the questions. And we need to figure out what the categories are, and that'll be a specific thing for that customer. And then, so the LLM will categorize in some, and there'll be like an uncategorized. And you'll manually review the uncategorized and determine new categories. But generally, you'll see these questions come in, you'll categorize them, then you'll say, what's our, and then you'll track feedback. That's the other thing. Did I answer your question? Yes or no? On the nose, like we were talking about before. And then you'll say, okay, what category of questions is giving us that is what should we look at first? That's going to be the category with probably the most amount of negative feedback and the highest volume of usage. That's the best opportunity for us to make an improvement because we can't improve everything all the time all at once, right? And then you'll go through and you'll find that use case and say, oh, the salespeople thought that they could ask it and it would answer questions from Salesforce. And it can't. How do we solve that? The simple thing is let's actually make a tool call for Salesforce that says, if you're trying to look up customer data, use this tool. But then the tool just says, returns to do not implemented. Like basically like, you can't do this yet, you know? But then it'll at least tell the salespeople, hey, sorry, I don't have access to Salesforce yet. You'll have to log in at this URL and access the data. And that's a graceful way to handle the negative use case versus be like, oh my God, now I have to build a Salesforce integration and all stuff. It's like, you don't have to do it today, but you could at least, you could really improve the quality of your product and user experience by just putting a tool call in with a no op to with a to do implement me basically stub on the method, right? Now that doesn't, you don't do that forever, but it, yeah, you want to identify the negative cases, like you said, and maybe you just can't or won't support that, but you put something into the product so that it's clear that it can help the user understand what it can do. Because if it's just a chat box, it's like, and you go to something like it can do anything. It's like, well, anything asterisk. No, it can't. It can do a lot of things, but not anything. So it can do things. What things? Oh, just try it. And it's like, okay, well, that didn't do the things I thought it could do. And then they don't like it. So yes, identifying the negative use case and then addressing it doesn't necessarily have to be implement everything and be everything to everybody. It can simply be make it clear that we are not doing this. It's not part of our offering.
Or then you can look in the back end and say,
maybe you might want to make it part of your offering if it's the predominant use case, right?
So, yeah, 100 salespeople are looking up questions from Salesforce. Probably spend some money on that. And there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
And so just the last question from my end is, what do you do to learn about what's new and possible with AI?
I try to make explicit space for that in my schedule to do it. It's easy for me because I'm building a product, I'm building a business and trying to take advantage of it. And I personally want to get good at it. So I think as advice to like anybody in general, right, it's really, you got to figure out for yourself and your role, like what can you do? And it's part of it is doing it, right? It's the teeny tangent. There's some famous study or whatever where it's like, professor in art class says, you know, you, half the class, submit one photo, your entire grade's based on this photo. The other one's like, submit as many as you want. You actually graded based on volume. And then, so just submit a ton of pictures. Literally, whoever submits the most gets a perfect score, right? And then they took all the data and they said, okay, now let's look at the 10 plus the 100,000 photos and find out which one are the best ones. And the 10, none of them were in the 10. It was all about getting your reps in. And eventually they took the best photos. Mm. And so it's the same thing where it's like, you got to sit down and just do it. And just sometimes it's try it and realize, it doesn't quite work there. Or I haven't figured out how to get it to work there. So learning is doing. You got to just do it. And then you have to figure out for your role, where can I do it? And some of it's going to be, does my company offer us a license for these tools? No. Okay. Is it banned? Is it a problem? Okay. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Okay. Some of it might just be like, you ought to just pay for it yourself. You know what I mean? Like the free version is good for ChatGPT and all this stuff, pay for itself. Because it's not that much money. And if you're like, you know, when you think about developing your skill for the future, because, you know, where we're going, is that going to take your job and all this stuff? It's like, I mean, I'm not saying someone else is. No, someone else who knows how to use it is going to take your job, right? This is a new efficiency thing. It's, I don't know how to type. It's sorry, you're going to get left behind and you got to learn QWERTY. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you think about it, like, we go all the way back. Like, people used to put, I know how to use Microsoft Office and PowerPoint on their skills on their resume. If I see that now, I'm like, that's almost a bad smell. It's just like a given, right? You know what I mean? So this is the next evolution of that. So I can type. I can use Word. I can do a mail merge, you know what I mean? Like, whatever. Like, these are, okay, mail merge is still, people don't know how to do that. But, you know, because you don't do it that often and whatever. But this is what that is. You just have to start doing it. And you can get simple value out of it. That's not rewrite this or stuff. It's let's challenge this from this perspective. I love that use case. It's great, you know, because you can almost anybody can use it multiple times a day and get value out of it.
Yeah. I just interviewed someone who described it as a cognitive companion for thought. Like just bouncing ideas off of it. It's such a, I think I struggle with taking the full advantage of it, but it's so useful.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Is there anything before we go that you would like to share about what you're doing that you haven't already and how people can stay in contact with you?
Yeah. No, I think we hit the nail on the head. I mean, like, Dan, you know me, I can talk if given space to talk. So, but I'm always happy to connect with folks, right? So, I mean, I have my personal website you can put up in the show notes, has like contact info on there. So, you know, if you're interested in, I'm going to be hiring eventually, not right now, but hiring. So if you're interested in what we're doing, drop me a line. I don't have an ATS, but, you know, I can keep a hold of your email and ping you in the future. And that's the easiest way, I think. That's the only thing. Yeah, leave it at that.
I started this podcast because I wanted to stand at the gate of businesses using AI and see what separated hype from lasting impact. Back when cities had walls, you had to go into the city to do business at the market. So, if you wanted to talk to someone, you waited by the gate until they came in or came out. Do that enough times and you could talk to everyone. That's what I want to do. Stand at the gate of people doing business with AI and talk to them, see what they do and why they do it. If you know someone that's making an impact in the world of AI, would you connect them with me? You can find me on LinkedIn or shoot me an email at daniel@maneri.house. That's daniel@manary.house. Thanks for listening.